Without further ado, I'm happy to introduce Mark Churchland. Mark is a product of Paul and Pat, of course. They must have had some fun. He got his PhD with Steve Lisberger at UCSF, where he worked on visual motion. And then he did his postdoc with Krishna Chinmoy at Stanford. He's a recent recipient of a new innovator award, which is kind of a new thing from NIH. It's kind of like an NSF PYI Young Investigator Award. It's described as a R01 on steroids. And it means that he's not quite a pioneer yet. He's just an innovator. Without further ado, I welcome Mark. Thank you for coming.
And so begins the session on motor control. So this is normally the part of the talk where you thank the organizer for inviting you. But a couple of things became clear to me during Gary. Some things which I wish had never become clear to me. I've never been invited to give a keynote before, and so I was sort of thinking, well, you know, who are the first five distinguished scientists that must have said that they were busy before they said, ah, to hell with it, let's just invite Mark, he'll come. And now I realize that I don't think that was probably it. I think that given the dwindling funding situation, they just wanted to save on hotel bills. And they said, well, who can just stay cheaply and be fed by their parents? I think that explains rather a lot. So I'm going to start the talk with the sort of obvious observation that by now we're all very used to the notion that neurons recorded from cortex. I very much did not mean to say motor cortex. Neurons recorded from cortex in general represent aspects of the outside world. So in this case, you're all probably quite familiar with this movie from Hubel and Weasel. And the neurons they're recording from are representing things like the position and direction and orientation of that bar of light. No, you're not. I mean, we could, but everybody's seen the movie. So sort of to drive that point home, here's a neuron that I recorded back in the aforementioned Steve Lisberger's lab from visual area MT. It's a directionally selective neuron, as almost all neurons are in area MT. And that means when you turn on a stimulus that moves in its preferred direction, the neuron gives a nice vigorous response. And when the stimulus is moving not in the neuron's preferred direction, so in this case downwards, the neuron actually shuts down a little bit. And so one would be inclined, and we typically do say, that this neuron is representing something about movement direction so that the rest of the brain can use that information. And I'm going to pause and make two points, both of which are so obvious that one would normally wouldn't even bother to say them out loud. And the first is that what this neuron represents or prefers doesn't change halfway through the stimulus, right? It's not preferring upwards motion during the first half of the stimulus and then suddenly starts preferring downwards motion during the second half of the stimulus. If the neuron did that, we would consider that very strange and somewhat disturbing. And if many neurons did that, we would question the idea that the job of these neurons was really to represent direction. And the other way in which these neurons carry a reliable representation of direction is that they would respond similarly for many different stimuli. So this is the response of the neuron for moving dots, but if this had been moving bars, a flock of flamingos flying across the retina, the neuron would still have preferred upwards motion. So this paradigm, this way of thinking about the job of neurons, has been so successful in the visual areas that very quickly it influenced how we thought about other areas as well. And so here's a classic example from Georgopoulos and colleagues, where they have a monkey reaching in 8 different directions. And the key observation is that the neuron is most active when the monkey is reaching to the left. And so you might say, well, this neuron is representing the act of leftwards reaching, much like those MT neurons represent direction of visual motion. And indeed, the data are usually analyzed in a way that reflects that belief. So in this case, we have the firing rate of the neuron being plotted as a function of direction of motion, implying, of course, that this neuron is coding or representing the direction of motion. And indeed, one can fit the responses of neurons with these sorts of tuning functions. The details of this aren't important. What's important is that the firing rate of the neuron on the left is being accounted for as a function of some number of parameters that the neurons tune for, in this case, just the direction of the reach itself. However, even in this original paper, the authors stress that this approximation worked well only for some neurons. And their main point was really that most neurons are active for most reach directions. You know, that's what they call a population code. It wasn't the case that every direction just had one, you know, that a given neuron liked only one movement. Most neurons give at least some response for most movements. And they said that the nature of this population code, what it actually was, remains to be elucidated. And I think, you know, those of us in the field would all agree with that statement. So if we're going to try and elucidate the code, both in general and maybe a little bit over the course of the next few slides, we're going to have to ask questions like, what do individual neuron responses look like in motor cortex? And not just as a function of things like direction, but as a function of things like time. How do the responses vary with time? And is this sort of directional tuning consistent and reliable in the same way that we're used to from the visual cortices? So the talk's going to unfold in three parts. The first part will essentially just attempt to answer that question. I'll show you that the responses of most neurons recorded from motor cortex are actually, at least on the surface, seem surprisingly complex and strange and don't really make much sense from a representational perspective. So in the second part of the talk, we'll try and ask whether those responses make more sense in the context of pattern generation. And then we'll wrap it up by basically trying to ask whether much of what seems complex in the single neuron responses might actually not be so complex and might be explicable in terms of simple underlying patterns. So before I can tell you what the responses look like, I have to tell you what the task is. The task is a variant of a standard delayed reaching task. That means the monkey starts touching a spot in the middle of the screen. We're going to turn on a target. The target jitters slightly in place, and that's the monkey's cue that he's in a delay period. He may not reach for that target. He may not look at that target. But what he can do during, sorry, I should state very clearly, we call this the delay period. That's the interval between when that target comes on and when he's finally allowed to go. So during the delay period, he can't move, but he can prepare his movement such that when we give him the go cue, he can execute his reach rapidly, accurately, and get his reward quickly, which is, of course, his reason for playing this little game. And while he's doing that, we're recording sometimes with just standard single electrode techniques, but more and more often using what I used to call these newfangled 4x4 millimeter silicon electrode arrays, although they're reasonably common by this point in time. And we implant typically two of these, one in motor cortex and one in premotor cortex, and record the activity of those brain areas as the monkey's performing this task. And before showing you real data, I wanted to show you what we all sort of thought or hoped a sort of canonical neuron recorded from motor or premotor cortex would look like. And so this is the firing rate of our cartoon canonical neuron as a function of time. This is the moment when the target comes on. This is the moment when the go cue is given. So this is all the delay period or preparatory activity here. And the idea is that the neuron would be active during the preparatory period, as indeed most neurons are, and would have some preference. So for example, maybe this neuron gives you a bigger response before an upwards reach, right? It's coding or representing the monkey's desire to reach upwards. And that preference would then be maintained and, in fact, would even become stronger as the movement came to be generated, right? And one then imagines that perhaps there's some sort of a threshold involved here, such that the actual movement itself, which starts here, is triggered when neural activity passes that threshold, when the strength of the representation becomes strong enough to actually pass threshold and evoke that movement. And the problem with that view is that it's very unrepresentative of the response of the vast majority of neurons recorded from motor and premotor cortex. I'll give you one example here. This is the response. So now this is going to be the firing rate of a real neuron that I recorded as a function of time. During the preparatory period, the firing rate of this neuron rises. So this neuron clearly is involved in motor preparation because the monkey isn't actually moving yet, but the neuron's firing. And then the neuron exhibits this rather complex multiphasic pattern during the reach itself. But you might still say, well, okay, there's clearly some messy biology going on here, but to a first approximation, the canonical model seems to be roughly right. This is a neuron that's coding or representing upwards reaches, and it does so even more strongly, you know, during the movement. And let's not worry too much yet about what those funny little wiggles are. And you might be encouraged then if I showed you how this neuron responded during the preparatory period for a downwards reach. You'd say, yeah, this really does look like a neuron that's representing upwards reaches. Except here's what this neuron does during the movement period for the downwards reach. Right? You can see that this neuron, in some sense, cares deeply about direction. There's very few time points where this neuron doesn't strongly modulate its firing rate as a function of direction. But it doesn't care about it in any consistent way, not in the same sort of way that we're used to from the visual cortices. Early on, there's a preference for upwards reaching. By the time the movement begins, the neuron is vastly more active before a downwards reach. A little bit later, the neuron's much more active for an upwards reach. And I think we recorded, because these were array recordings, something, you know, order of 3 to 5,000 trials from this particular neuron. So each of these is the average firing rate across something like, you know, a few dozen upwards reaches. And that means that these firing rates are highly representative. If I put standard error bars on these, they'd be very tight. So this isn't sampling error. It's not noise. This is truly what this neuron was really doing. And I'm going to delve a little bit more into detail on that just for one slide, because I want to show you that the neuron I just had up there wasn't cherry-picked to make that point, that what I showed you is highly representative of the population as a whole. And so I'm going to go briefly into a population-level analysis of that. If you already mostly believed me, you could probably more or less tune out until the next slide. So to do the population-level analysis, what I do is I take a reference point early during the preparatory period, and I measure that neuron's response for all the different reaches that we've trained him to make. And then I do the same thing a little bit later during the preparatory period, and I ask how correlated are those preferences. If the neuron liked upwards early, does it still like upwards now? And so I'm going to compute that correlation for each neuron and then just average across all of the neurons. And you can see that as long as you're within the preparatory period, things don't change very much, right? This red dot here is way up close to one, meaning that whatever the neuron prefers during the early part of the preparatory period, that's still its preference during the later part of the preparatory period. But as the movement comes to be generated, by the time of the actual movement, there's essentially zero correlation between what gets this neuron to respond most vigorously. Zero correlation between the preferred movements here and the preferred movements there. And that has fairly large implications for not only how we think about the responses of these neurons, but what sorts of analyses are likely to be revealing as opposed to confusing. And so here's an analysis that's very common in our field and really in systems neuroscience in general, which is that to summarize the response of a population, you should compute something called a population PSTH. So you take the average response of every neuron for its most preferred condition, the average response of every neuron for its least preferred condition, maybe a couple of conditions in the middle. And when you do that, you get the summary of how the population is responding, and that you can see that it's nice and, you know, strongly tuned, strongly active during the preparatory period. But it seems to shut down around about the time of the movement. And we know that that's not true. These neurons are incredibly active around the time of the movement. They're responding very vigorously. The reason why this appears to happen in this plot is because there's essentially no correlation between a neuron's preference here and a neuron's preference there. So sorting neurons by their preference doesn't really make very much sense because their preference is constantly changing. And we can reveal that that's indeed what's happening by instead measuring the neuron's preference around about here, taking exactly the same data and averaging according to the neuron's preferred neuron's preference measured at this point here. And now you can see we get a completely different plot. And so these kinds of plots can be useful, but can also be dangerous. And I'm mostly going to try and stay away from them for the remainder of the talk. You'll see that instead, I try and summarize the population response in a different way. And that's by using something called a state space plot. And the key advantage of the state space plot, well, there's a few of them, but one of them is that it avoids this problem of averaging the data in potentially non-representative ways. So returning from the level of the population back to the level of the single neuron, what I showed you were the responses of this neuron for an upwards reach and for a downwards reach. But I also hinted that we recorded a vast number of trials from this neuron, and most of those were not for upwards reaches or for downwards reaches. We, in fact, had the monkey making 108 different reach types. So the monkey reached, of course, in all different directions, but he also reached he had curved reaches that curved this way, curved reaches that curved that way, long reaches, short reaches, pretty much everything that we could train him to do on a flat screen in front of him. And associated with each of those reaches is an average firing rate, right? A trace that looks like one of these two traces, but is for those 106 other reaches. And here they all are laid on top of one another. Here are the actual reaches, the 108 different reach types that correspond to these 108 firing rates. And I've just color-coded them red to green based on the level of preparatory activity, just as a visualization tool to allow your eye to follow at least as best it can what's going on. And you can see that there's this nice structure present during the preparatory period. Neuron gives stronger responses for some movements than others. In fact, tends to be upwards movements. But then around the time of the movement, you know, it's as if all hell breaks loose, right? It's like some bomb went off in the brain. I mean, how do we understand what's going on during this time period here? It doesn't look random or structureless, but it's very hard to look at just this neuron and figure out what's the relationship between this preparatory activity here and all of this sort of crazy complexity that follows. And that's really what we're going to be wrestling with. And I'm going to actually try and claim that this complexity is actually nowhere near as monstrous as it looks. It's actually fairly easy to understand. But before getting there, I just want to hammer on the idea that this is not just one neuron that I cherry-picked. This is highly representative of the responses of most of the neurons that you'll record from motor cortex. In fact, it's rare that you'll record two neurons that look the same. It kind of makes recording fun because every neuron you record has a different pattern from the last 100 neurons you recorded from. Very, very different than, say, area V1 or area MT. So when faced with these kinds of complex responses, what people have mostly tried to ask is, what's being represented that could explain this complexity? What are these neurons coding for? And here's a controversy with which MO is all too familiar. So to a first approximation, our field has been consumed by the following argument for the last 40 years, which is, what's being represented? And there's been two possibilities that have been heavily pushed. And one possibility is that motor cortex, of course, creates movement. Movement can be parameterized by things like hand velocity. And so maybe that's something that motor cortex should know about. And so motor cortex should contain some sort of a representation of hand velocity. And if we went and recorded for motor cortex, we should see things like that. And so that's been one point of view. And of course, that also implies that if you record the response of a neuron, you can explain that response as a function of the things the neuron is tuned for. In this case, the horizontal and vertical velocity of the hand. And if these don't do a good job, then you maybe can add some other terms in as well, like a position, say, for example. And the opposing view has been the following, which is, well, yes, motor cortex controls eventually movement, but the first thing it does, really, is it sends activity down the spinal cord that impact muscle activity. And so we should think of motor cortex as sending a muscle-like command. It's actually a view I have a fair bit of sympathy with. And in that case, what you would expect to see is that if this is the response of a muscle, so now I'm plotting as the actual recorded response of the deltoid, so this muscle here, This is how electrically active the deltoid is as a function of time. You can see the deltoid becomes very active, it pauses, it becomes active again, and it sort of settles again at this high plateau. If this is what's happening in the muscles, then you might reasonably expect to see those same patterns in motor cortex, because after all, you know, motor cortex has to create those patterns in the muscles. They've got to get there somewhere, and so they should be coming from motor cortex. And in that case, you should treat the responses, or let's say explain the responses of individual neurons as a function of the muscle commands that are being sent, so as a function of the muscle activity. And so these views are very different, and I have my opinion about which one I like better, but I want to point out that they both have something very much in common, at a formal level, at least. And that is that they treat neural activity as something that can be thought of as a tuning function for the parameters that are being represented. And the real argument has been over what's being represented. Is it things like velocity or is it things like muscle activity? But I want to pause for a second and ask whether or not this is really what we should expect. Right? I mean, this seems reasonable. You know, write down an equation like that, argue over what the parameters are and what f is, but is this really what we expect? So, in order to make this next point, I need to assume one of those two views. And so I think that these folks here have made a fairly good case that something like this is going on. And so I'm going to, at least for this course of the rest of this talk, I'm going to go with the supposition that motor cortex sends a muscle-like command. So in that case, you expect to see a pattern like this in motor cortex, right? But think about it for a second. Things are very different than they were in visual cortex, right? In visual cortex, the pattern of light falling on the eye caused the response in visual cortex. But it's not as if the muscle activity caused the response in motor cortex. Sorry, I might have said you know what I was trying to say. In this case, it's not as if the muscle activity can cause the response in motor cortex, right? The response in motor cortex causes the muscle activity. So that raises the very obvious question, something that many of us have been interested in recently, of how that response comes to be present in motor cortex. Right? Okay, let's say that these guys are all, that they're essentially correct. There's still a huge mystery. How do you create that response? Okay. And if you dig through old papers, you can see that they really did believe there was some sort of upstream pattern generator. They would call it a motor program. I'm not sure pattern generator is quite the right word, but I've got to use some words, so I'm just going to pick that one for now. But something upstream that can create these patterns of activity. And one then, of course, immediately wonders, well, what would neural activity recorded from some kind of pattern generator, some flexible pattern generator, look like? And then, of course, immediately you're led to wonder, well, do we really think that motor cortex is going to be downstream of that pattern generator, or might motor cortex be part of the larger circuitry that's involved in producing this temporal pattern? And that really, and if it did, what would the responses in motor cortex look like? Because now they're not going to just look like the muscle commands, they're going to look like the dynamics that are necessary to generate the muscle commands. And, you know, a number of people, including people sitting in this room, and I'll also give a shout out to Eb Fetz from years ago, have made a very, very similar point. I'm just going to put up one quote, because it's the most recent one I could find, where Steve Scott writes that motor cortex, this is his hypothesis, is intimately involved in the generation of low-level muscle commands. And I've highlighted the word generation because I think it's the most important part. Right? He didn't say conveying commands. He said generating commands, right? That somehow we need to think of motor cortex as generating the commands that are going to be sent to the periphery. Generating these temporal patterns of activity, which are very finely structured and have to be finely structured. You send the wrong temporal pattern, you're going to get the wrong movement. So this really is sort of the dynamical systems perspective applied to motor cortex in a nutshell, which is let's slightly, not completely, but temporarily slightly defocus ourselves from the argument over what the final commands are and focus on what's at least as interesting a question, which is how did those commands get built, constructed, generated, produced in the first place, and what were the neural dynamics that did that? And I hope you'll forgive my slightly over-the-top analogy here, but if you were to record from, say, that cam, you would probably have a hard time relating what you saw with the overall straight line movement of the car, right? Any engine is going to have moving parts that don't relate to the final output of that engine, right? And so really what we're trying to ask is, for a neural engine, what should those moving parts look like? Can we take a guess at what they might look like, and can we go see if we can find them? So moving briefly away from reaching, I think it's worthwhile before going looking for, pattern generation could be a lot of things. So it seems worthwhile grounding ourselves a little bit with some examples where I think we all have reasonable intuitions about what kind of pattern generation might be expected to be seen. And so I'm going to start with the walking monkey. The data I'm going to show you is recorded from an array implanted in motor and premotor cortex. Here is this particularly handsome creature. His name is Isaac. He's been trained to walk on a treadmill for juice reward. These poles are just there to keep him from escaping should he decide to pick a fight with another monkey. He's just walking so that he can stay at the front of this treadmill and drink his juice. And while he's doing that, this little canister here is wirelessly transmitting out 32 channels worth of neural data. So this is data that was recorded not by me, but by Paul Nuyajukian and Justin Foster back in Krishna's lab. And when they lend me their data, I projected all 32 dimensions worth of neural data down into a two-dimensional state space. And I will break down for you in a moment what that means. But for now, just roll with it. And what we saw were these rotations in neural state space that kept pace with the rhythmic walking movement of the monkey. And as you'll see in a moment, they stop when the monkey stops walking. And we weren't sure that we would see this, but it was sort of what we expected to see. And I want to break down for you why we expected to see that. And we're reassured that we did see that. I want to consider this one of the simplest possible circuits that could produce a rhythmic pattern. And two neurons that are recurrently connected, these are going to be excitatory synapses. That's going to be an inhibitory synapse. Okay. Now, we could model this by treating these as continuous valued rate units using some sort of fairly linear model. Those of you who are fond of this sort of thing will quickly note that because this matrix M here, which captures the connectivity, is skew symmetric, that's positive, that's negative, the solutions to this differential equation are going to involve sinusoids, they're going to involve rotations in state space. But moving beyond or lateral to the math, let's just sort of step through the neural logic of how a circuit like this generates a rhythm without worrying about the equation itself. Let's say that neuron 1 starts being active. Okay, so over here in our state space, the state space is just a convenient way of plotting data. It will be incredibly familiar to some of you who've been using it since before I was born and kind of mysterious to others of you. So I will step through it a little bit carefully. What we've got here is the firing rate of neuron 2 plotted versus the firing rate of neuron 1. And of course, when we start out, firing rate of neuron 2 is at its baseline, right? And firing rate of neuron 1 is high, right? So when we start, we're at this point here in state space. Now, neuron 1 is going to excite neuron 2, and as it does so, neuron 2 is going to inhibit neuron 1. So a little bit later, neuron 1 might be back closer to its baseline, and neuron 2 will be more active. And so that's what we expect to see over in state space, is neuron 1 falling back to its baseline as neuron 2's firing rate rises. And what that is just simply a rotation in state space to that new point. Now neuron 2 is no longer receiving much input from neuron 1, so it's going to start to shut down. As it does so, both neurons are going to become quite inactive. And so what we expect to see over here in state space is now both neurons to be below their baseline firing rate, right? And we continue along our circle. Now neuron 1 has been relieved of its inhibition. It can start to excite itself again. And so neuron 1 is going to become active again, and we will have literally over in our state space come full circle. So these rotations in state space, this is often a very useful way of visualizing the dynamics, but an equally useful way is to plot the firing rates of each neuron as a function of time. And what you get are just two sinusoids that are 90 degrees out of phase, which is, of course, exactly what gets you a circle. So I don't mean to propose for an instant that there's a little two-neuron circuit somewhere in your brain generating movement. But the same mathematical, logical principles that are embodied in that network can be embodied in vastly larger networks, networks that do fancier things, that can absorb feedback, that can be very stable in the face of perturbations, but they may still exploit that same basic logic that we stepped through right there. And to drive that point home a little, here we've got a completely different animal with a completely different nervous system. So the data I'm going to show you, it was recorded by Kevin Brigman and Bill Christen from the swimming leech, or more precisely from the disembodied nervous system of a leech that thought that it was swimming. And when I took their population data, which was recorded optically, and plotted it in one of these state spaces, what we see is something very similar to what we saw in the walking monkey, right? So, you know, no suggestion that there's a similarity in the underlying circuitry, but there is perhaps a principle at play in both cases that's not completely different in any case. So now, of course, I'm not plotting neuron 1 versus or neuron 2 versus neuron 1 anymore. I'm reducing a large population down to just two dimensions. If you're not used to thinking of, so first of all, I should say we did this using a variant of principal component analysis. If you're not used to thinking about the world in terms of principal components, just think of this as the firing rate of one particularly representative neuron, and this is the firing rate of another particularly representative neuron. And if you think that way, all of your intuitions will be correct, at least for the rest of this talk. But what's actually being plotted is a response pattern that's strongly present in the data versus another response pattern that's strongly present in the data across many neurons. So to break down, you know, sort of discuss dimensionality reduction a little further, partly just to be reassuring, you know, you say we reduced the dimensionality or we used factor analysis or PCA, and people will sometimes look at you a little strangely. They're worried that you're doing something odd with your data. And actually, all we're doing is something that you're incredibly used to already. You're all very used to the idea that you can take a population of neurons and you can decode something. So, you know, I give you a population of neurons that are tuned for velocity, and you decode velocity. Right? I give you a population of neurons that's tuned for position, you decode position. All these state space, or sorry, all these dimensionality reduction methods do is extract the basic patterns that are present in the data in the same way that you might have had you decoded. The one key difference is you don't actually have to know what you should be decoding in order to get these patterns. It can give them to you even if you don't yet know what it is that you should be decoding, which is a good thing because we don't know. You'll see here that I plotted the data as a function of time, but it may often be the case, especially if you notice that two patterns are closely related, that instead of plotting each pattern as a function of time, you may prefer to plot one pattern as a function of the other. Certain things will be easier to see in this visual representation. Certain things will be easier to see in this visual representation. It's the same data either way, needless to say. So, what about the case of reaching then? Is there any sort of similar pattern generation going on during reaching? And, you know, at first blush, it really doesn't seem like there's any reason to expect that. These are not rhythmic movements. The monkey starts with his hand at one point, executes a very rapid reach to another point. He does not go back to the beginning until well after the period of time that we're discussing here. So there's nothing overtly rhythmic about these reaches at all. But there sort of is, if you look down at the level of EMG. So here we have our friend again. This is the EMG, so how electrically active the deltoid was as a function of time. And you can see there's quite a fine, you know, quite an intricate temporal pattern to the response of this muscle. It's not just some big hump of activity. You know, the brain clearly had to do some work in shaping this pattern. And it's not rhythmic. But if you stare at it for a while, you might imagine, hey, I could probably build that from just a couple of rhythmic components. What if the brain could generate one brief little rhythm at one frequency and another equally brief rhythm but at a slower frequency and sum those two things together? Might they approximate or produce the EMG that the organism wants? And you can see in this case that actually works surprisingly well. So the question is, does it work well not just for, this was the deltoid activity for a rightwards reach, does it work well not just for a rightwards reach, does it work well for all of the all of the different reaches that the monkey made. And the answer, let me first go with the prediction, which is that if the brain were using a strategy like this, it should be easy to construct muscle activity from two underlying components. And you should be able to do it for all the different reaches that the monkey made. And in fact, that is true. Here on the left, we have the real EMG. So each of these traces is the average muscle activity for one of 27 different movements that the monkey made. So the monkey makes a lot of different movements. Each of these is the average activity of the deltoid for one of those movements. On the right, we've reconstructed that activity just as the sum of two simple underlying rhythms. And critically, the two rhythms are not allowed to change for each of the different reaches. Right? So if one of them's at 2 hertz and one of them's at 0.5 hertz, they're always going to be at 2 hertz and 0.5 hertz. The only thing that's allowed to change between these different movements, you know, upwards movements, downwards movements, is the phase and amplitude of those two underlying patterns. And it turns out that you can fit, and across the data sets, the accuracy ranges from 0.97 to 0.99. So you can fit stunningly well the real EMG activity simply as the sum of two underlying little rhythms whose phase and amplitude is allowed to change depending on whether you're moving up, right, down, left, whatever. Now, I don't know that that proves anything. Maybe it's just a fitting exercise. But it does prove one thing. It proves that if the brain wanted to generate this EMG according to that principle, it could. That would be a very good way of doing it. Many other good ways of generating this EMG. But that would clearly be a good strategy and a fairly simple one. So at the heart of this proposal is the idea that, yes, you know, you may be sending a totorovian muscle command out of motor cortex, but you need to build that. And so you're going to need multiple patterns present in motor cortex in order to produce this final output. And in fact, you're going to need even more than just these two, because focus just on this one for a moment here, right? So remember back when we had our little two-neuron cartoon network, you couldn't do that with just one neuron, right? So to get a sinusoid at one phase, you've got to have another sinusoid at another phase. It's sort of a dynamical necessity for generating sinusoids. They can't just sort of spring out of nowhere. And so you're going to need, in order to generate this pattern, sort of a little friend that's 90 degrees out of phase, and then the same thing down here as well. And so you're going to need at least four patterns internally in order to generate one external pattern. And it's not just that there's four patterns. It's there's four patterns that have a very tight relationship, or at least in pairs with one another, such that if I plotted pattern two versus pattern one, I should see a nice, clean rotation in state space. And so that's really the key thing that we're going to be looking for in the neural data in the following couple of slides, is do we see in the neural data rotations in state space during reaching that look like briefer versions? Say again? Well, what time did I start?
You have until 9:45.
Okay, what time is it now?
9:30.
Okay. These patterns have anyway, we're going to look for things like this. So here's a movie, and it's going to be a movie of actual neural data. This is a neural state just before the reach starts. Okay, it's going to unfold in time. The fact that this neural state here is not right on baseline there simply is a reflection of preparatory activity, right? The monkey has had time to prepare his reach. The neural state has moved away from baseline. Now, in our hypothesis, what that's doing is setting the phase of the rotations that are to follow. In the older hypothesis, this is some sub-threshold representation, right, of the reach that the monkey wants to make, and it should grow in strength and vigor as the monkey becomes more certain that he wants to make that movement and actually triggers the movement. So which of these two things do we in fact see? What we in fact see is a rotation through state space that looks rather like a briefer version of the kind of pattern generation that we saw during walking. Okay, so but how is some, I mean, you say pattern generator, it sounds like something very rigid. How is a pattern generator going to generate all the different movements that the monkey's able to make? And the answer, as we've already sort of hinted at, is phase. So So here's the initial neural state before a rightwards reach. Here's the initial neural state before a leftwards reach. They're 180 degrees out of phase. Maybe that's because these targets are in opposition to one another. But watch what happens during the actual movement itself. It's a very similar pattern in both cases, very similar dynamics at play in both cases. It's just 180 degrees out of phase, presumably because the initial state started 180 degrees out of phase. And just to gild that lily a little bit, here are 108 different initial states corresponding to the 108 different reaches that the monkey made. And you'll see that each of them leads to a rotation with the appropriate phase and amplitude. And it's a very robust effect. Here's just four examples, but we've seen it in every data set we've looked at. I do want to stress three things, though. The first I've already, I think, stressed, which is that each of these isn't a trial. It's the average neural activity for one of 108 different reach types. The second is that what's important isn't just that you go a loop and come back. What's important is that you seem to be obeying something like lawful dynamics. And here I mean dynamics, at least approximately speaking, in the strict sense, which is that you can define a state space the way that an engineer would, and that there's then some rule that says wherever you are in the state space, that determines where you're going next. And in this case, the rule can actually be approximated using a fairly simple linear approximation. It's clearly not quite right. There's some growth early on, and there's some decay late. But more or less, the neural state seems to be obeying a fairly simple flow field. And so when we say dynamics, that's what we mean. I think I've already stressed the fact that the preparatory state seems to set the amplitude and phase of those rotations. And we think this is very important because it gives preparatory activity a reason for existence, right? This is why we hypothesize the brain bothers to set a preparatory state. The third thing is that while it's easier to see and understand dynamics in a state space, in particular, for example, you can tell that these are all going in the same direction and that there aren't some of them that violate the dynamics and go backwards. Sometimes you just want to think of these things as patterns versus time. So if you project this data onto this axis, you get one pattern versus time. If you project it onto that axis, you get another pattern versus time. What are these patterns? These are just response patterns that are strongly present in the data. So many neurons strongly reflect this response pattern, and many neurons strongly reflect that response pattern. And of course, the duality, I mean, in some sense, if you get this, it's really 80% of the talk. The duality between these two representation or display formats, let's call them, thinking in terms of state spaces and thinking in terms of time, is sort of what we're hoping explains a lot, right? That it's easiest to see the dynamics unfold in a state space, but the fact that the projections of these things onto a vertical axis trace out sinusoids is what allows the brain to produce the EMG. So for example, you project the red trace onto this vertical axis, and you'll see it goes up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. You project the green trace onto this vertical axis. You see it goes down, up, down, up. All right, I think I may skip some controls, except to say that standard traditional models and a variety of sort of shuffle controls don't show this effect. You don't get this effect simply because you have crazy multiphasic data. Rotations produce multiphasic responses, but there are lots of things that are multiphasic, and most of them do not reflect underlying rotations. Underlying rotations are something kind of special, and I think I will blow through this point as well, which is just sort of... All right. So I stress the lawful relationship between where you start and where you're going next. Why wasn't that present? Why wasn't that obvious at the level of the single neuron? And I think the answer is actually blindingly simple, which is, and it's easiest just to illustrate it. So here I've got a very simple simulation, neuron 2 versus neuron 1. And I'm going to create 27 random preparatory states. Okay, 27 random preparatory states. If you project those things down onto this axis, you get the firing rate of neuron 1. And you can see it spreads out as these preparatory states spread out. Now, all I'm going to do is just rotate these things lockstep with one another. Right? Simplest possible dynamics. Things couldn't be simpler here. They could not look more disastrously complex at that level there. Right? And these patterns here are not just arbitrary patterns. They actually came from a model that I used to really fit EMG. So I'm going to skip a few things. I can actually simulate the responses of neurons as a function of those underlying patterns. So these are what neural responses would look like in that very simple model. And I put to you that most of you will have a hard time telling which of these are real neurons and which of these are model neurons. In fact, really the only way you can tell is that the preparatory activity is unnaturally stable in the model neurons. These are model neurons and these are real neurons. And so all of the sort of crazy messiness that we saw and sort of didn't like in the real neurons is very much present in the simulated neurons at all. It doesn't reflect any monstrously complex biology, and it certainly doesn't reflect messiness. It's just hard to see the logic of the system at the level of a single neuron. I guess the one caveat I do want to linger on a little bit, as first of all, clearly we don't know the circuitry that's generating this. We do not know if this is intrinsic to motor cortex, probably not. And we're not even really sure that we understand the general principles at play. You know, would one of MO's networks, once trained up and doing a good job, produce these sorts of things in its innards? It very well might, right? It's not clear that we have to think of this as simple pattern generation. It may be that a fairly complex controller would also use these simple principles sort of as a, you know, just to get things rolling. The other thing is, you know, because this is a very natural way of solving the problem, very different circuits can solve the problem in at least somewhat similar ways. And so we don't know whether evolution is recycling old principles or whether it's just sort of reinvented anew every time. And secondly, this is a great way of building the patterns of activity that generate rapid movements. Do I think that this is going to explain all of movement generation? I don't think that if you wanted to generate a ramp of EMG, I don't think this is probably a good way to do it. You know, mathematically speaking, yes, this could be the sum of a bunch of sine waves, but I doubt very much that the brain would choose to use that strategy. Okay, so this point has sort of, I think, been driven sufficiently home. I do want to state that these aren't the only patterns that are present in the data, but they're certainly the strongest coherent patterns in the data. I'll blow through some of those details. And sort of finish up with a philosophical point, which is that, you know, for a long time, primary visual cortex has stood as this paradigmatic example of where thinking in terms of representation is the right way of understanding our data. It suggests the right analyses to perform, and presumably is, roughly speaking, the right way of understanding the role of that chunk of brain. And I think a number of us suspect that motor cortex is or will soon come to be the sort of canonical cortical area that gives us a paradigm for thinking of our data and the role of that chunk of brain in rather different terms, in terms of pattern generation. That these are the concepts that tend to suggest the right analyses and explanations. And these two things don't have to be in opposition. For example, certainly you could use dynamics to produce a representation. And in some sense, we're proposing that that's exactly what's going on. But they are a little different, at least at face value. And when you think primarily in terms of representation, you think of decoding the responses of your neurons. And you think of decoding things that you can put labels on. And if you get some patterns that you don't understand yet, well, they're representing things that you don't know about yet. And you should go figure out what those things are, because they're things that are being conveyed to the rest of the brain, right? These things are represented because the rest of the brain wants to know about those parameters. And in this case, that's only a little bit true, right? There is, of course, a final output, but many of the patterns that are there don't exist to, they exist to produce that final output, but they're not a representation of it. And in particular, this pattern here looks a lot more like velocity than it does like muscle activity. This pattern looks a lot more like position than it does like muscle activity. You might be very tempted to say, this is a representation of velocity, and this is a representation of position. And that couldn't be further from the truth, at least for this model. And finally, these patterns aren't just any arbitrary patterns that sum to create that. And this, in some sense, really is the crux of the dynamical view. It's not just any arbitrary basis set. It's a basis set that can be generated using, hopefully, dynamics that we can understand. So I'll finish up with an image illustrating the importance of motor preparation. This is Krishna on the occasion of getting tenure. And you can see that some of us knew what was going to transpire, and we're able to prepare our movements accordingly and keep our children safe. Although you can't quite see, there is actually a cliff over there, but I'm at least 10 feet away from it. And some of us did not know what was happening, and did not have time to prepare, can be seen trampling their own children in a vain attempt to escape the inevitable. Although these guys, a couple these are some skinny guys. He almost escaped. They had a hard time getting that thing over their heads. It turns out that engineers have a much harder time playing that trick than football players. So thank sort of a bunch of the obvious people, including a huge shout out to John Cunningham. Most of this project really wouldn't exist without our collaboration together. Matt Kaufman, very talented graduate student who's actually now a postdoc, just to keep things even weirder with Anne, my sister. And then Stephen Rue, just in case you were concerned things weren't incestuous enough. Stephen Rue, our neurosurgeon, and then a huge influence of actually both of these fellows on both our initial thinking and continually on our most recent thinking about how these sorts of systems might actually work. And then huge thanks to the people that fund my lab and to you guys for sitting through the talk.
In particular, basal ganglia inputs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm reminded very strongly of a very recent Nature paper that debunked the go/no-go independent pathways in striatum up through as being sequential, but as being simultaneous, so that both go and no-go are simultaneously represented until 500 milliseconds or so before the movement.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether there's input in the motor cortex that may be playing a prominent role.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, clearly, you know, unlike, say, a spinal CPG gets input, but it can at least do its thing without input. Clearly, of course, you're right. There's no way motor cortex can do this without input. And it needs input at the very least of two different kinds. It needs inputs that set up that preparatory state correctly. And then it needs another input to do something that I really kind of elided, which is what turns the dynamics on and off, right? What's the go signal that says, okay, you were just sitting here in a nice little preparatory state ready to go, and now you're going to swirl, but you're not going to keep swirling forever, right? You're going to turn that pattern off after 1 to 2 cycles. And you know, what does that? What is the go cue? And is it coming from the basal ganglia? Is it coming from prefrontal cortex? Can it come from different places depending on the nature of the task, whether you're being, you know, thoughtful and trying to get the exact moment of movement right, or whether you're being sort of highly reactive? Can different chunks of brain trigger motor cortex? It's a question we're deeply interested in. About the only thing I can say for that input is that we do think we see evidence of it in motor cortex, a trigger signal coming from other areas, and it predicts the monkey's reaction time incredibly well. The earlier input, which sets up the preparatory state, in some sense is the hard part, right? Like, I actually haven't really said anything about motor control. If I took all of this and I went to Emo and I said, hey, Emo, the right way to build a robot is to have it generate its actuator patterns by summing together sine waves, he'd look at me and like, Mark, what are you talking? I mean, of course I can sum sine waves to do, right? So, you know, we haven't really said anything about control. We've said sort of something about pattern generation. And one of the hardest aspects of control, there's feedback too, of course, but one of the hardest aspects of control is getting that preparatory state right. Right? You know, how does your controller, your big smart controller, get that preparatory state in just the right place? How does it feed motor cortex just the right input such that when it does give the go cue, it does the right thing? And, you know, so that, and we haven't even touched that. But then, you know, we're all very happy having a characterization of V1 neurons that we like, and we still have no idea how vision works. But it's still progress to at least know that they're tuned for orientation. So, yeah. Yeah.
Really great talk, Mark. Thanks. Loved it. I just thought you were being a little modest when you restricted your
claims about the generality of this work to motor cortex. I was thinking of Paula's work right when you were saying that. That's all about perception, actually, but it's all about perceiving, you know, rapid change in speech sounds. And, when we think about perception of action, we watch people act.
Yeah.
It's not like we're always just looking at a static scene and stuff like that. So, I mean, it must be that these kinds of processes, I don't know if adding sinusoids together is going to be quite the right way to think about it, but they must be relevant to perception, which is, it must be a dynamic process.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I think, I agree. I think even thinking of perception solely as a bunch of slavish responses to an external stimulus, you know, hey, that works great at the very beginning. But anytime you want to compute, you're going to have response patterns that are related to that computation but aren't directly related to either the stimulus or the final output. They're the thing that links one to the other. But they might look a little mysterious on their own. So I completely agree. I mean, they probably won't be sine waves, but they might have a sensible dynamical interpretation in terms of the context of the goal of the circuit, and yet look mysterious from a representational view, even in a perceptual area. I agree, yeah.
So you present this from the view of classical neuroscience, mm-hmm. where you take the electrical signal and you strip out everything except a few identified neuron spike records. Mm-hmm. But in fact, of course, it's the neuropil that has its function, right? So these are not isolated neurons living in their own universe. They are. They may be neighboring, they may be not neighboring, they may be connected in a field some sort of field gradient, or certainly in some sort of topology. So have you thought about extending the modeling to how the more of the neuropil actually participates?
Yeah, I mean, there's a broader question there of, you know, what are the circuit properties that produce these dynamics, right? And part of the problem there is that, you know, I mean, a lot of people would like us to do things like, you know, go in and start hitting everything with channel rhodopsin and figure out, you know, which interneuron subclass is responsible for this, and which, and it's very tricky because, say again? Yeah, not, you have to get somebody else to do that, but yeah. We'll discuss that one offline, but yeah. The probability you'll get me to do that one is fairly distant. I mean, these are big firing rate oscillations that at a fairly low frequency, right, that are strongly visible in the responses of individual neurons, not high-frequency oscillations that are weakly visible in the responses of individual neurons, but only seen at the level of the at the level of, say, scalp potentials. The other thing is that I don't think there's any evidence that these oscillations would ever even appear in LFP, because they're out of phase with one another, right? So if you plotted the phase for each neuron, it would go around 360 degrees. And so if you were to just take the total response of all of these neurons and average them together, you would see nothing oscillatory in there at all. It would just go meh, because, you know, some things are at this phase, some things are at this phase. So, you know, I don't think we can get it. I mean, it would be nice if we could. I don't think we can get at this using LFP type things. And the circuitry, big mystery, right? There's just too many kinds of circuitry that could be doing this.
Sorry, the reason I jumped in is because last year, in the first talk, we had a talk from David Sokol, and he said, very strong correlation.
I'm
just tons of robust phenomena showing up in that kind of data. And I sometimes worry that single unit people don't look at it because they don't believe it's there.
Well, I mean, we almost have the opposite problem, which is that we record it, and I feel like it's very easy to stick a smart graduate student on an LFP recording project and have them sort of never emerge again. And so I really, even though we record it, I actually really try and avoid analyzing it, because it's not that I don't think there's anything interesting there. I think it's that it's easy to get stuck analyzing it and be stuck there for a long time. And it, especially in motor cortex, where unlike some of the other data sets you were mentioning, there's not strong phase locking of individual neurons to the LFP. In fact, neuron-neuron spike correlations are so weak in motor cortex, they're almost unmeasurable. And the little bit of LFP that's present in motor cortex, which is beta band frequency, actually shuts down during movement. I mean, there's essentially no LFP present in motor cortex during movement. So, I'm not giving a prescription for how everybody should analyze everything in the whole brain. Clearly there are places where these oscillations are very strong, but in motor cortex, not my cup of tea. Yeah. Thanks very much.